back to Ryan O'Brien's Bible Bistro. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Brian.
And this is the Bible Bistro, a podcast all about the Bible, theology, and...
all things.
Say it.
Say what?
Say the word. Say the word. Related. Well, I want you all, if you're watching on YouTube, we have a one-of-a-kind mug that we've made that gives to Brian, and it says... a podcast about the Bible, theology, and all things pertaining, and pertaining is crossed out and related to the Christian faith. And I want you to know, I've brought this up several times, that Brian has a problem with words, but you were telling me over a cup of coffee this morning
I've spent a lot of time
thinking about why you have chosen the word pertaining.
Well, pertain, you know, related is just, is there's no necessary... causal relationship, but pertaining to, you know, it's something that is relevant to the Christian faith. So it could be something that's related without any kind of relevance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's what I do.
Yeah.
I exegete.
Yeah. Oh, well. Anyway.
I should get that license plate. I exegete. I don't know.
That'd be a very niche audience to be like, what's this guy trying to say? Some family on a road trip to be like,
nine, well, like Roman numeral nine.
My gosh. Anyway, so we're back to the Bible Bistro. Yeah. We're together for the first time.
We're in the Bistro East.
Yeah, we've shared a cup of coffee. We've talked about all of our personal issues. And
we haven't talked about all of our personal issues. You started talking about your personal issues. I said, that's enough. That's all I can handle. No more.
Let's go to the podcast. Yeah, because if it's recording, I
gave you the number of a good counselor.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, awesome. So we're back, and we're talking about something. If you're here, you're probably thankful, hey, they're not talking about Leviticus today. That's right.
Come on.
We're not talking about Leviticus today. So, we're going to talk about something else.
From the ridiculous to the sublime, we're going to Romans, of all places.
To Romans. So. Yes. Well, part of this conversation is, you know, you and I regularly have conversations. We'll talk on the phone during the week. And, hey, I've read this. This is interesting.
It's usually calling me up going, Brian. Explain this to me.
No, oh, Brian.
I really appreciate that voice you just used. It really...
it captures you.
The essence of me.
Brian.
Brian, I need your help.
So we're talking to some... Oh my gosh, this is off the rails. So I was reading it in Romans. I was reading some from your friend Tom, as I know him, Tom Wright. I know him as N.T. Wright. And also reading through some Romans stuff. And I thought it was an interesting topic.
Oh, was it Paul and the Faithfulness of God?
Paul and the Faithfulness of God.
Just a little light reading.
That's volume two.
Paul and the Faithfulness of God.
That's a two-volume set. It's not a small book. But N.T. Wright's done quite a bit of work on Paul. Yeah. And...
he's well known for his work in Romans as well.
Yeah, so one of the things I was thinking about, especially as we just got done with Easter, is one of the things that N.T. Wright has kind of talked about recently, and this is kind of a hard concept around wrap our minds around, is when Jesus on the cross, is it wrath? Is it love? Like, how do we think about the wrath of God? And I was reading some of his work and then reading Romans, and I thought it was interesting. He pointed out, and I thought this was kind of an interesting thing to think about, is in Romans 1, Paul says, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed." We've all read this before.
Verse 17. So that's chapter 1, verse 17.
Yeah, this is 17. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. A righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Mm-hmm. Now, in our Bibles...
There's a paragraph break here.
But then, and I had not seen this before, this is an interesting thing for me to think about, is how much even the formatting of our Bible affects how we read this. Because then in verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed. And so N.T. Wright's talking about for in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. And then 18, the wrath of God is being revealed. And so how do we think about it was weird for me to go the wrath is being revealed and kind of ruminating, what does it mean that wrath is being revealed? And so that's what we're kind of
talking about today. Yeah, so and I love this passage. This is a great passage. There's a lot going on here, but it is not an easy passage, and he even problematizes it a bit more. So this is actually taking me back. The origin of this podcast, you'll remember, is I think you're reading Surprised by Hope.
I was reading Justification.
Justification. and you called.
Is the F for everything that started everything here.
So it was that conversation. You're like, oh, we should record this. So that's how it all started. That kind of took me back. So yeah, let me read this again. This is the NIV, and this is verse 17. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that's by faith from first to last, just as it is written. He quotes here, the righteous will live by faith. Habakkuk, or is that right?
Oh,
or Haggai, I can't remember.
Habakkuk 2:4.
Okay, then the verse 18, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people, as the NIV used to say, men. Now, the problem is in verse 18, not only do we have a paragraph break, but as Wright points out, and I don't think I had noticed this before, the Greek conjunction there is the word for. Gar is the Greek word, but it means for, which shows a causal connection between this idea of for in the gospel. In fact, I took his translation. I'm going to read his translation. If you don't know, Wright has translated the entire New Testament, and he wrote a book, Romans for Everyone, too, a two-volume, that's pretty good. It's more of a kind of a sermonic commentary, but it has that translation in it as well. Here's how he says it, and this is going way back up into starting in verse 15. So I want you to notice I'm going to emphasize the fours here because Paul uses it repeatedly. I am eager to preach the gospel in Rome, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is God's power for salvation to all who believe, for God's righteousness is revealed in the gospel, for God's wrath is revealed from heaven, because what can be known about God is plain to them. So he kind of highlighted those phrases, and particularly the conjunctions there. Now, four is his whole thing here is that that shows a connection with what goes before. There are other conjunctions Paul could have used. De is kind of more of a general kind of but, or a connective kind of and that doesn't mean too much. But gar, the way that he uses, and he makes the case that Paul uses it intentionally to show this line of thought.
It's building on top of it.
It is building on top of it. And I'll say Romans, well, I'll come back and say some more about Romans.
So just with this idea that they're building on top of it, we shouldn't separate them. Like that there is Paul is trying to, is building an argument on top of
something. I think so. I think, and he's connecting particularly these two ideas. And so this causes the problem then, in what way then is, this is really what Wright's dealing with in the section that you were showing me. This is, if you're following along in Paul and the Faithfulness of God, 764 or something like that.
For all of you that have had your two volumes sitting right next to you.
So volume two, page 764. So the big thing he's saying is, in what way is God's wrath revealed in the gospel? And here's his point, is some of the ways that people talk about this, it's not a new revelation. And when Paul used this idea that in Christ and in the gospel this has been revealed, it's not talking about those things that have gone before. And so he goes through several commentators. He talks a lot about Douglas Campbell, who's a pretty recent interpreter of Paul that has made some different kinds of ideas. But then he goes back to C.K. Barrett, some of these other well-known commentators on Paul. And he shows that really none of them are really that giving us a great idea of what's going on here. The first idea is that Paul is not making this close connection. And like, again, he shows that it seems like Paul is not, he uses this language pretty intentionally. The other idea is that, well, it's just talking about what has always been known, that the wickedness of humanity requires a response of God. But the point is, that's nothing new. That goes back to the garden.
Exactly. Right? We already know this. God's already revealing his justice in some of these ways.
And so this idea of the revelation then, in what way is this a new revelation? And I guess I'll cut to the chase, and I'll actually quote some of this, and then I was gonna talk about some other things first, but I'll cut to the chase. Here's what Wright says. I'm going to read this. Once we see that Chapter 1, verse 18 through 2:16 as a whole, we note that the whole passage is framed by the revelation, which consists of the news, itself part of the gospel, that God's judgment will be executed through the Messiah. So the new thing is that in the same way that it's kind of a new revelation, especially I think for Paul, the Damascus Road experience, that it's through Jesus, right, that God's righteousness becomes revealed, not through the law, but in a righteousness that is not according to law, but is from faith in the Messiah through the Messiah's faithfulness, I guess I should say for yes. right. But through Christ is this righteousness revealed, but it's also this idea that it's going to be through his Messiah, Jesus, that his wrath is revealed. And this idea of judgment, I think, particularly. This made me think about John chapter 5. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You have that passage, John chapter 5, verses 19 through 23. Because even in his own, in his life, Jesus makes a pretty significant claim here. And here, I'll just give you the Jewish worldview. There's a couple of things very clear in the Jewish worldview. One is that God is the one who gives life. And this is really getting at this, at what's going on here, because Jesus has just healed somebody on the Sabbath day. Mm-hmm. And they're going, you know, you could have waited, because it was not a life or death issue.
Right.
It was an issue of him being a paralyzed person for a long period of time. And so Jesus responds to their criticism. He says, God works to this day. Basically, God works on the Sabbath. And this was a rabbinic understanding in the first century that life is given on the Sabbath day, life is taken away, people die on the Sabbath day. And that was all seen as God's purview. Mm-hmm. That was something that belonged only to him. So that's one thing. God is the giver of life. He's the one who takes life away. The second thing that was very clear in the Jewish worldview is that God is the ultimate judge, mm-hmm. right? Now, listen to what Jesus says. Given that background, thinking that God is the giver of life and God is the ultimate judge, listen to what he says in John chapter 5, 19 through 23.
Jesus gave them this answer. Very truly, I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. Yes, and he will show him even greater works than these, so that you will be amazed. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he is pleased to give it. Moreover, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him.
Now, you kind of understand why that's a pretty significant statement in a Jewish worldview.
Yeah. And Jesus is taking the place of, not taking the place,
but he's claiming given the authority mm-hmm. that God alone has this kind of authority. Now, here's the problem for a first century Jew like Paul. In fact, Wright goes on later in this section and talks about this. You know, Paul would have recited the Shema multiple times a day. You know, hear, O Israel, Lord our God, the Lord is one.
Right.
This is their central statement of faith. Mm-hmm. So the whole question that is being wrestled with in this section is, how is a first century Jew to understand monotheism, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that we believe in one God, and we do believe in one God, but yet the Messiah is now claiming these kind of authorities that belong only to God. Now and I think it's a very creative way that Wright brings this in. He says this explains how this is a new revelation. The revelation is that, you know, in the same way that righteousness comes through the Messiah, mm-hmm. which is a new, it's revealed, right? Mm-hmm. It's revealed also that wrath comes because of the Messiah and his judgment and this mm-hmm. this idea. So that's what I think Paul's really getting at, is what a revolutionary idea, how that is a new revelation mm-hmm. that would have come. And of course, again, for a Pharisaic rabbi like Paul, he's going, you know, I had to come to terms with this. And he's writing this also to people who are dealing with this. Mm-hmm. This is what I was going to say early. It's important to understand this. We haven't done much on Romans. I was thinking about that. It's kind of unusual. Romans is a very interesting book in Paul's letters. And here's the way I always say it, is that the book of Romans is probably the most carefully constructed. Carefully is not the right word. It is the most tightly woven argument, extended argument of any of Paul's writings. Now, I want to be clear what I'm saying here. All of Paul's letters are occasional. And what we mean by that is he's writing to a specific situation. Mm-hmm. So, give me a letter, Paul. Well, Philemon, we've dealt with a lot. We've seen that.
Colossians
is written because of the situation with Philemon. I say it's mm-hmm. an occasion, right? It's a situation going on.
Timothy. Perfect.
Yeah, Timothy's right. You know, he's writing to someone, a young preacher who's dealing with some issues in the church in Ephesus, and so he has some very specific things. Don't let anybody look down on you because you're young. That's an occasional situation, right? Because it's written to that specific situation. All of Paul's letters are like that. First Thessalonians, they've been kicked out of Thessalonica. Here's a young church that's left without, you know, any kind of direct revelation. So he sends Timothy back, and you know, he's worried about them. So there's always an occasion that gives rise to them. Now, here's the interesting thing about Romans is Romans is written to a church that Paul has never been to. And it's clear if you look earlier in chapter one, that's pretty clear. Where did I'm completely off my notes now. So back chapter 1, verse 8. First of all, I thank God through Jesus Christ for all of you because your faith is being reported all over the world. In other words, everybody's talking about the church in Rome. You know, what an interesting thing that here.
Yeah. And Paul, I mean, they're talking about them, but he has some idea who some of the people are.
Oh, absolutely. Because
at the end of the book, 16, he's got there's a whole list.
He empties his Rolodex. Yeah. And I'll say something about that in just a minute. God, whom I serve in my spirit, this is verse 9, in preaching the gospel of the Son, is my witness how constantly I remember you in my prayers at all times. And I pray that now at last God's will... Now at last, by God's will, the way may be opened for me to come to you. So you see, I'm saying he's not come to them yet. He in fact, he goes on, I long to see you that I may impart some spiritual gift to make you strong. That is, that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, that I planned many times to come to you, but have been prevented from doing so until now, in order that I might have a harvest among you, just as I've had among the other Gentiles. I mean, Rome is kind of, you know, think about this, and you gotta put yourself back in that situation. It is the city, largest city in the ancient world. It is the center of empire, center of culture. There's a way in which we have nothing that is equivalent to this today. This is the city in the world. And so Paul's desire to come and to have a harvest among the Gentiles is, you know, this was the center of Gentile thought and the world thought, and yet Paul's not the one who planted the church there. So all these other churches, Thessalonians, the Corinthian church, Ephesians, you know, all these churches are ones that Paul had planted, but this not is one that's own. Not. Now, you mentioned that he mentions everybody that he knows in chapter 16.
Yeah, I love what you said. He emptied his Rolodex at the end.
So I think in order to make this connection, because Rome, you know, all roads lead to Rome, right? It was a place where people would move to and move from. And so he says, anybody he knows that's even remotely connected to Rome, I think he mentions them, right? And that's why we have this long listing of names there. It's not because he's writing like he does in Colossians, where he calls out some people by name, you know, and that kind of thing. It's not that. It's more of trying to connect with this church in Rome. So here's what I'm going with all this. So the argument in Romans is not as much guided by specific situations. Look at the book of 1 Corinthians is my counterpoint. Is he says, here are some things you need. Here's what I hear, that you guys are disunified. So he spends four chapters dealing with that. And then he says, now the matters you wrote about. let me answer you step by step. No, you shouldn't sleep with your stepmother. You know, you shouldn't take one another to court. You know, he goes very specific things that he's responding to. In Romans, it is the of all of Paul's letters, it is an occasional letter, but it is the most thoroughly worked out example of here's what the gospel is and here's what it means. And that's why it's such an important book for us, I think. It is not, some people have wanted to make it almost like a Pauline systematic theology. He's still writing for a very specific purpose. And in fact, I would say Romans is a missionary document, because he later in the book says, I want to come to you so that you can help me go on to Spain. My plan is to continue to take the gospel to the ends of the world. That's what he saw as his mission. And I think Paul thought—
preparing them.
Yeah, I think when Paul thought, when I do that, then that's going to be the end of the world. Then Christ will return and you know, we can be happy then. But he, you know, he's like, I want to preach. I preach the gospel here. It's spreading. And now I want to go to places where it's always been my ambition, he says, to preach the gospel where it's not been preached. So that's why he's writing. But in the midst of it, especially these first eight chapters, is a very tightly woven together argument. It's very hard to take out one part of this, as people often do.
What?
Without thinking about how it fits within the whole. Mm-hmm. So that was a long.
No, that's a long, long set, introduction, but it's good. It's good.
So here's the other thing: the church in Rome was clearly made of both Jews and Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of debate about this today. Romans
16 alludes to that. We have Jewish names
and Gentile names, and also the rest of the book. He makes very specific cases, and I think that's what's going on here. And we'll get into kind of a verse by verse exegesis here in a minute. And I think that's what Wright is saying here as well, that the new revelation is that it's not only. God's righteousness isn't through Torah, but it's not through law, but God's righteousness is through faith, the faithfulness of the Messiah and what Christ has accomplished. The other new revelation here connected to this is that judgment and Paul or Paul, Tom Wright, Wright makes this point that this wrath is a future thing. In Paul, it's always a future. This is a coming wrath. Mm-hmm. I had a few passages I was going to read to kind of show you that. 1 Thessalonians 1:10. I'm actually going to read this in the NIV, and then I have it in my notes in the New Revised Standard Version because it's kind of unfortunate the way the NIV has translated this. And he says, and to wait for his son, God's son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. So there's that idea, the coming wrath. But
you would say that's Jesus's wrath that's coming, or God. So whose wrath is coming?
Well, it's God's wrath, right? And this is what I'm saying is Paul. I shouldn't say Paul's wrestling with it. I think Paul's worked it out, but he's dealing with this idea: how's a monotheistic Jew supposed to understand Jesus as the Messiah having the same authority as the Father? Mm. And that's where we end up. Of course, we believe in the divinity of Jesus, but that is a remarkable
statement,
a remarkable transformation. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that shows us what a profound impact Jesus' ministry had and his resurrection had as well, is here's these people who are monotheistic that are now attributing to different persons divinity, right, being God. And so that's what I think is being dealt with here. So here's the New Revised Standard Version. And to wait for his son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus Christ, who rescues us from the wrath that is coming. So this idea, I don't know why, there's some other, well, anyway.
What were you going
to
say?
I can't remember. I'll have to think about that some more. But it's this idea that it's future wrath that is coming. It's God's wrath that's coming, but it's this idea of the judgment that will come. But Wright's saying here that it's coming because of the Messiah, because of what he has accomplished. So let's go back to chapter one. Let me just kind of walk through this then some of what's going on. Now, you talked about this. He said, I'm eager to preach to you who are in Rome. I left that off, that's where we left off in verse 15. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm coming to preach to you because I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile, right? Mm-hmm. So he's saying that it's true for both. Let me go back. So this is where I think from a Jewish perspective, the Torah was seen as that which is, which we need. And he's saying now instead it's the Messiah. Verse 17, for in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, as it is written, the righteous will live by faith, or that could be translated, the righteous one will live by faith. And then verse 18, here's the connection. For the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And I'll go ahead and say this now, and then I'm going to show it to you a little bit later, but I think what is remarkable here, I'm trying to think how to even put this. So Paul's going to talk a lot about this idea of wickedness and suppression of truth. And I think the Jewish members of the audience in the church in Rome are going to be applauding. They're going to be going, yeah, those dirty Gentiles. Uh-huh. They don't keep law. They do all kinds of despicable things. Mm-hmm. And Paul's point's going to be, but it's true of us too. Mm-hmm. We're not righteous because of keeping covenant, of keeping Torah, any of that, we are righteous because of the faithfulness of the Messiah, of what he has accomplished. And so that's the new revelation. I think that's why he's mm-hmm. so careful in laying this out. And the judgment is going to be related not to the good acts that we have done, not according to
law-keeping, the
keeping of Torah, but it is going to be the wrath of God is going to be revealed against those who do not trust in the Messiah.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying? So
that's the Jesus is the vessel through which wrath is going to come, not keeping Torah.
Yeah. And it's the same thing that Jesus said in John. Mm-hmm. If you honor the Father, you got to honor the Son as well. And he goes on and he basically says, if you don't honor the Son, then you're not honoring the Father. Mm-hmm. And so that puts you in outs with God. And that was, the thing that Paul needed special revelation. He needed to be, blinded on the Damascus Road in order to figure this out, because it was such a big deal for the Jewish person that this crucified man, right, the crucified, cursed, he became a curse for us, as Paul says, crucified, according to the Romans, that he was worthy of worship, mm-hmm. right? That was the major. I don't want to say this. This was the bolt out of the blue, so to speak.
Becoming Trinitarian was a big deal. You know what I mean? Like, well, it's
for
just
for a monotheistic.
Yeah, to go to Jesus, and then the Spirit 50 days later. Yeah. We're getting into.
Yeah.
This is a hard. Hard transition here.
And again, I think it speaks to, that's one of the things that shows what a remarkable thing the resurrection of Jesus was, that they were able to incorporate this idea. And again, Christians, we are monotheistic, right? But mm-hmm. it's that the view of the Trinity is because we see three persons who all are divine.
Okay.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. So you asked me, what is the wrath of God? Here's what I would say. What do I mean when I say the wrath of God? It's not an arbitrary anger. It's not God striking out against his enemies or anything like that. What we have to remember is that this is the creator of the universe. And again, that's another thing John attributes to Jesus. The very beginning of the Gospel of John, all things were created through him. Not one thing that was created, nothing mm-hmm. that was created without him. So the creator of the universe made his creation in a particular way, and the rebellion of that creation, you see, puts us at odds with the creator. And this is the hard thing that we have to understand. He's not just one of the – I'll tell you some language that bothers me. I don't usually kind of talk about this, but you hear sports stars say it sometimes. I hear – music stars say it sometimes when they're giving credit to the way God has helped them. The man upstairs is the way that they refer to it. Not exactly. We're talking about the creator of the universe. We're talking about the pre-existent, all-powerful creator of the universe. We talked about this when we looked at Leviticus and just that idea of God's holiness and how carefully you remember when the priest didn't come into his presence in that way, how careful we have to be in coming into his presence because of who he is. And that's kind of the idea here. Our sinfulness has put us in opposition to God. And so God's wrath is there's no adequate word for me to even express this. You just have to kind of get the picture. This is God's stance in relationship to the rebellious universe, to the rebellious creation. So us, right? The sin that we brought into the world and the way that it has affected all things, I don't even want to call it a response because it's not God reacting. Mm-hmm. It is God being who he is, and we have turned ourselves aside from that. Mm-hmm. And so that puts us in this adversarial, it makes us enemies of God. Mm-hmm. Right, puts us in this adversarial relationship with the creator of the universe, which, by the way, is not a good place to be.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, well, I think, most of the times when you think about this, and again, I'm a reference N.T. Wright, I listened to one of his speeches, we have this idea that there's a big, angry, kind of, I think, bully God that's like,
I'm going to get my way.
That's like this
angry God, and you know, it's always this juxtaposition between for God so loved the world, but then wait, he's angry and right. like, you know, I think that's always that kind of that hard thing to, you know, for us to think about, you know, partly I think it's because how it's been talked about for so long.
I think that's correct. I think it's
that we get into it, but just that there's always been like this hard play sometimes like, well, God's angry. Well, and he's, I was talking to someone the other day and they were part of a Bible study and he was like, you know, what is God's wrath? And, you know, yeah. God's pulled the arrow back and, you know, he's whetting his sword, you know, reading from right. Psalm and some of these things. Right. And it's like, you know, why did Jesus have to die? It's because, you know, God's wrath has to be, you know, yeah. like he's up there ready to explode.
Has to be satisfied.
He's up there ready to explode with his anger. Right. Yeah. And so, and then you're like, well.
He's like an abusive father.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard. I get it. It's hard to wrap our minds around. I'm thinking also what the most famous. We even had to read this in school. I believe the most famous sermon in all American history is "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Right.
Oh yeah.
That's kind of our
Johnny E.
Our legacy, right? But it's again. So it is an outgrowth of God's holiness. We mm-hmm. would say, and so wrath is. When, you know, so we think about these things, suppressing the truth. So God is truth. Mm-hmm. And those things that are against that are in opposition to reality. Mm-hmm. I've used the example of the electromagnet before, you know, when yeah. we talked about sin, that it's a repulsion, right? There's this mm-hmm. natural repulsion. And see, naturally, you can't even talk about because it's God. It's the creator. Yeah,
well,
of the
you know, what you said was all kind of was really interesting short. To me is like, it's not a response no. of God. Like, it's his. It,
we that, react.
Yeah,
we react.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, that's yeah. a mind bender a little bit to think about that it's not a reaction of God. You know, like, it is us. It's a move of us away from
we're
God.
We're the ones who've put the separation there because of our sin.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting, you know, yes. I'd never thought of it that way, that it's not a response of God.
And this is why we're so careful with our language.
What?
And the words that we use.
Well, but, I've already said some stupid things in this episode. But
and I'm sure I have too.
To my credit, though, I've said them and immediately known as soon as it crossed my lips, I said the wrong thing.
Well,
like fair vessel, point. I said vessel, and I'm like, no, that's not right, and you corrected me. But.
The you know, there's this good English word for it that we don't use very much anymore. The ineffable, right? It's almost more than we can fathom because we're talking, and if we weren't, it wouldn't be the creator of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. So. So let me go a little bit further here with what we're talking about. So mm-hmm. the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And I'll go ahead and say, I think I see this whole section as a kind of a Christian commentary. Well, let me put it this way. It's a Pharisaic rabbi who has become a firm believer in Jesus as the Messiah, who is commenting on Genesis 1-3. So we're talking about the creation and the fall in this section. That's how I understand what's going on here. Okay. So if you think about the beginning of that rebellion of the universe that we're talking about, the rebellion of us as his creation, it begins with a lie. Mm-hmm. And this idea not only of a lie, but a suppression of truth, mm-hmm. of putting the truth out. And I've said the whole Bible can be understood as a battle between truth and falsehood. You know, Jesus, again— not to quote John again, but Jesus says to the people who are criticizing him because of what he's telling the truth about who he is, you know, he says, you are of your father, the devil. He was a liar from the beginning, right? And when he lies, he speaks his native language is the way the NIV's translated that, his idios, he's speaking his, like we use the word idiom, right? Mm-hmm. He's speaking, when he's lying, that's... That's his nature, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, God is truth. So that you know, truth is unchanging. Truth is not something that is bendable. It's not something that is you know, there's no such thing as multiple truths. Mm-hmm. There is truth and there is falsehood. We'll say more about that perhaps a little bit later. But so here's he goes on in this. So those who suppress the truth by their wickedness. So the point is, left to its own, the truth is obvious, is what Paul's going to say. The truth has to be suppressed because of the wickedness of humanity, because what is true is plain. And so here's what he says. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For, here's the way in which it's been made plain. Since the creation of the world, so there you see we're getting into this idea of creation, God's invisible qualities, and I love this, I'm gonna take out this middle part, God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen. And there's an irony there, right? God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen, okay? But here's the middle part. God's invisible qualities, namely, Paul would say, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people or men are without excuse. Mm-hmm. So Paul is saying that you can look at creation. We call this natural theology, right? You can look at creation and you can know something about God. Mm-hmm. And namely, it's these two things, his eternal power and his divine nature. And the way is, again, it's ineffable. But here's what I will say. You can look at the universe. We're coming up again. By the magic of podcast time, we're coming up to this
eclipse.
This heavenly event that's going to take place only in our small solar system that is a part of this vast universe. So if you look at creation itself and you look at its hugeness, you recognize that whoever it was that brought this into existence, or if you're so inclined, whatever. But I am a theist, so I believe whoever brought this universe into existence has power that is beyond our comprehension. Mm-hmm. Oppenheimer was nominated and won Academy Award for the best picture. What was found there, Fermi, I think, is the guy who initially found it, is that when you begin a chain reaction of splitting atoms, the energy that is released is an exponential equation. Mm-hmm. And that's what gave rise to the bomb. That's what that whole movie is about, is once that was realized that it's an exponential, here's what it's saying, is that the amount of power that is released in a relatively small amount of matter is beyond what we would have ever thought in the past. We live now all of us live in the shadow of Oppenheimer's, as has been said. If you think about all the matter that exists in the universe, and I'll give you a hint, there's a lot of it, and you think about the amount of inherent energy within that matter, I mean, there's no way for us to even begin to comprehend that. And so we think about the one that brought all of that into existence. Mm-hmm. That's some people talk about science. Science should lead us to worship God. Mm-hmm. We should look at science and we should think, how is it possible? So that's the power. And then the others, I would say teleology, the divine nature, that not only is this just an immense amount of power that is inherent within the matter in the physical universe itself, but it is also an incredible order. Everything from the subatomic up to the solar system, mm-hmm. and beyond, to infinity and beyond. No, that
well, a little levity for this part of the conversation.
That divine nature is such that we can understand something about God. Now, general revelation, as we say, or this mm-hmm. kind of natural theology has limits. Mm-hmm. That's why special revelation, that's why God sent his son, right? Yeah.
I was just thinking about this as you're talking about this. We both listened to the podcast very recently. Oh, I told you need to listen to it.
Sure.
We've mentioned this several times, Surprising Rebirth and Belief in God. And it was an episode where these two guys that were very much kind of naturalist, very connected to nature, and they both had a sense there was something more. There was something on the outside of it, and they it took them a lot of different directions, but there was always this sense, and it has led them to God at this point. They found Christ and found worshiping God, and so it's interesting, to think about this. And this is also, as you think back, some of the other religions in the world, that's this kind of the same idea, that there's a sense of the transcendent that they're looking for through all this.
Now here's, you know, Paul's going to value the law, but he's going to say that we can even understand something about right and wrong from looking at the way God created the world. And that's where we're headed here with, mm-hmm. with the rest of this. So God's, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, or you could say from what has been created, so that people are without excuse. Okay, that the truth had to be suppressed. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor give thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. So, you know, again, when Wright was talking about this, he talks about this idea. It's not first a behavior problem. It's first a thinking and a heart problem. Their hearts are darkened. And heart, you know, this is difficult, but heart is not seat of emotion in a Greek sense. It's more, maybe we could call it the seat of the will.
Okay.
You see, and mm-hmm. we could, you know, take heart, for example, we could say, or, you know, I didn't have the heart to do it. We might use it some, you know, the seat of the emotions was the guts for the Greek. But the heart was more the seat of will, we could say. Mm-hmm. So it's the thought and the will that shows itself in our actions. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that because the truth was suppressed, their thinking became futile, empty, we could say, without any purpose, and their hearts were darkened, right? So that their wills are not in keeping with the Creator, right? But is against that. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. And here for this is again, the Jewish people are all standing up in Rome,
like, clapping. Yep, this is why we're the good guys.
They're all shouting Amen, right? Because it's seen in the foolishness of idolatry. And you can go back to Isaiah chapter 40 and following, where Isaiah says, you know, what a dumb idea. You know, the guy the guy takes a piece of wood and he takes half of it and he makes it in an idol and he bows down and worships it, and he takes the other half and he throws it in a fire and cooks his meal over it. You know, what a ridiculous view of the world, yeah. Right? And this is what he's getting at. He uses this idea of idolatry here. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal human beings and birds and animals and reptiles. So there's our idea of idol worship. Egypt, Canaan, Greek, Roman, you know, all these cultures that worshiped idols and things that were in the shape of the creation rather than the Creator. And the image is part of the issue here too, right? Because God's invisible, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
We can see something of his effects. We can see the created order in which he's placed us, but God is invisible to us, right? And so it's man's desire to, how do I say this, to control mm-hmm. the divine, which is, I've always said, that's the hallmark of religion and not true Christian theism, is we think we can manipulate the deity. So if we can shape it and then bow our knee to it, we can bend God to our will rather than conforming our will and our thoughts to his. We can put him in our thoughts and we can shape him to our will,
right,
which is the opposite. And again, that's the fall. That's Genesis 3. That's mm-hmm. what we're talking about and everything that's come about since. Therefore, And here's the big one, right? When you get a therefore, so mm-hmm. all this that's gone before, all this argument that's gone before, I want to preach the gospel because it's the way that God has revealed his righteousness and the wrath that's coming. And then we have this idea that people have suppressed the truth and this idea. And therefore, you know, there's all these things. Therefore, God gave them over to the sinful desires of their hearts, to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. So again, thinking and will comes first, and then we see this resulting in action. Mm-hmm. And particularly Paul mentions here sexual immorality. For the Jewish person, this was a big deal, but it's more than that. And we'll get to this in just a moment. But I'm reminded of what we said a couple of weeks ago, when we were talking about Leviticus. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are four things that Gentiles had to follow if they were going to be followers of Jesus. And the Jewish people said, No meat that's been strangled, no meat that's been sacrificed to idols,
mm-hmm. blood.
No blood, and sexual immorality, right? Mm-hmm. They need to observe these things because that's a part of it. And I said then we're created as sexual beings. We have all that stuff that's in there. And here's why I think Paul uses this specific example. He's going to talk about a lot of different things here in just a minute. But it has to do with you can look at the creation and you can see a way in which God designed it for use. Hmm. And particularly he mentions the degrading of our bodies. You can look at the way that God made our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And you can understand that there's a very particular way in which they are to be used. Mm-hmm. We're created as sexual beings, and there's an important aspect to our nature that he's talking about here. So they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. So they exchanged that, and they worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator who is to be forever praised. Amen. And we still worship. We still have idolatry today, not in the same form, but worship power and wealth. We worship pleasure. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different ways, and even the whole idea of the immanent frame that we've talked about. This idea that only the natural is what exists, in a sense, is a worship of the created thing. You mentioned these guys who were in nature looking. You know, there was something in nature, but it was the immanence, right? It wasn't until they saw the transcendence in nature that it led them to God. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the natural order itself, but it is that which lays behind the natural order. I was going to use the wardrobe thing if you want to talk about it, but that's a cool image they give. I'll leave that for right now. So here's the because then, 26. Mm-hmm. Because of this, God gave them over. And there's a lot that's been said about this. I don't know how you want to
handle it. Yeah, I'm just, what does it mean God gave them over?
Well, I think he allowed them to experience the result of their turning aside from him.
It's God just saying, like, you want to do this? I'm going to let you see end result.
I don't think it's an amplification, mm-hmm. right? I don't think it's like, well, I'll make it very bad for you.
He didn't set a new artificial barrier.
Think about, it's from the beginning, right? Think about the times in Israel's history where they had turned their back on him to the extent that he then allowed them to experience. You know, he's promised them if you do the things that I have asked, you're going to be blessed.
This is a little bit again, yeah.
Blesses and curses, or end of Deuteronomy,
right?
But if you don't, you're going to be cursed, right? And mm-hmm. and again, I don't see it as so much as God going, I'm mad, I'm going to get you, but it's more like God created the world to work in a very particular way, and when we don't follow that, there are repercussions of it.
Yeah, and you said it's not an amplification. It's not God putting behind him like, well, you want to do this, I'm going to push you further into this. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it is following the inclinations of our heart, our darkened heart.
The heart will take us there. We don't need God shoving us from behind.
Exactly. And so here's what goes on then. Because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts, even their women. And notice the statement from the lesser to the greater here, I think. Even their women exchanged natural sexual relations for unnatural ones. Now, what's he mean by this? And why is he
even
talking
their
about
women?
This?
Like, yeah, why is the emphasis on that?
So and I was really pleased to see Wright came down to the same conclusion I did on this, what I've always said. And he makes the point. Some people have said, well, it's because in Judaism, homosexuality was considered to be especially a thing, whereas in Greek society, it wasn't. And I don't think that's the main point. I always say, and I've said this to you about this, Paul always, when Paul's not talking about something, we learn a lot about what he thinks about it. I think he's using homosexuality here as an example of ethics and natural theology. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is, he says that you can look at the way that God created us and you can see a way in which things are supposed to work. Mm-hmm. And our suppression of truth and our running away from the way God has created us has led us to a point where even their women have exchanged natural relations. And he goes on and he continues, they were in the same way men also abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men committed shameful acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their error. So, you know, a lot of people will talk about the passages that deal with homosexuality. It's a difficult topic to talk about in our society because of, I think, the way we have suppressed the truth and so forth. But here's the point is I think Paul's using this as an illustration. And this is, in my opinion, the most powerful passage.
This isn't the main point. This is an illustration.
This is an illustration. And his illustration is this. You can look at the created order, and even ethically, you can understand that there are some things that are wrong. There are things that do not work in the way that God intended them. Again, God created us for sexuality, and part of that is the way that life and reproduction takes place, and that doesn't happen within the context of homosexual relationship. And you know, we could go on about that. I don't know how much more you want to say. There are people who've written lots about trying to explain some of these words, some of these Greek words. Now, I've looked at the context and I've read these words in other places, and I don't follow their argument. They'll say, oh, it's about power or it's about prostitution. It does fit in this sense with the idolatry, because in Canaan, part of idol worship was indulging in these practices. In certain Greek cultures as well, we see the same thing. In Greek worship, we see that there were certain practices that were part of this, sexual practices. And so faithfulness to God, you know, this idea of sexual faithfulness is one of the images that's used for our relationship with God as well. But that's not the primary point I think Paul's making. His primary point, I think, here is using this as an illustration to say you can look at the way things were created. And I've done this as a mental exercise. I've tried to think, what other sins can we think about that you can just look in the created order? And the only one I've come up with, and it's not as powerful, I understand why Paul used this illustration, is the idea of patricide or matricide, killing your father or your mother. I think God says, this is why we have the whole thing about honoring your mother and father, I think, and the penalties we saw in Leviticus for rebelling against your parents, because this, you know, if you take the life of the one who gave you life, that's against the order of things. You see what I'm saying? That's the only thing I can think of that would have the same kind of power, if that makes sense to you. And I think that's why Paul uses it as an illustration. And notice he's not using the words that are sometimes for homosexuality. He never says homosexuality here.
Right.
He talks about exchanging natural relations for unnatural ones. He's talking about the way that creation works.
Right. It's not monogamy or, you know, like homosexual monogamous relationships. It's just like,
it's not about power. It's about the way things are created and that they don't work. We have, Paul would say, we have suppressed the truth and our wills have become so twisted that we can't even see in the way God made us, the proper way for things to function. I'm going to use, and I know this is unpopular, but I'll use the word, he would say it has been, in the technical sense, perverted. It has been twisted, right? So anyway, other thoughts on that or questions or comments?
No, I mean, so he's kind of expanding like the wrath of God here or not. How does this tie back to 18 as we kind of see this kind of fleshing out here?
Yeah, so what I would say is he's actually talking about the effects of the fall is what I would say. And so, yeah, the coming wrath is because of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's not saying, oh, because you guys are homosexuals, then I'm going to bring this wrath. That's not what I think is going on. I think it is more, Paul is saying, this is the degree to which we have misunderstood God, and we misunderstood our relation to him, and this is where we find ourselves. Now, let me go just a little bit further here, because I think there's something else. Furthermore, you know, so he's adding to that point, just as they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind so that they might do what they ought not to be done. And again, this idea of giving over, I think, is just, again, them naturally coming to this. They become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. And here, I always love these lists that Paul gives us, these vice lists. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. We could break that down if you want. I mean, envy is this idea of wanting what is rightfully not your own, and it has to do with not having an appreciation for where you are, right? It's comparing yourself with another. Murder is pretty self-explanatory, inappropriately taking another life. Strife is the idea of arguments and causing upsetting peace. Deceit has to do with this idea of lying. Malice is having ill will toward another. They are gossips, right? Slanderers, God haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. There's kind of a play on the Greek words here that I'm not going to spend time going into. They kind of rhyme, so to speak. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. And again, that sounds so kind of strange to us because we've got all this list and then disobedient to parents. And we're like, what? But again, I think it has to do with recognizing the order in which God has created the universe, the way that he wants it to be. Want is even not the right word, the way that it is because of his nature. And so they have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of the ones who practice them. So not only do they do it themselves, but they also approve of people who practice it. Now, the death, again, giving over, the death, all this is the result of turning our back on the source of life, as we've talked about before when we talk about sin. It is what, you know, I think that's the due penalty he's talking about. He's not talking about, you know, some kind of special thing. It's spiritual death. It is, you know, to use Augustine's term, it is us becoming other than what we were meant to be, less than what we were created to be. Mm-hmm. It's us failing to live to our vocation. I don't know how else to say it. It's not what we were intended for, but turning our back on what we were intended for and receiving then instead separation from God, separation from life is what we're talking about. So again, everybody's like, all the Jews are like, get it, you tell them about the dirty Gentiles. And then, and here's where we get chapter 2, verse 1. You therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge another, you're condemning yourselves because you who pass judgment do the same things. I call this the universal law of hypocrisy, that all of you will criticize another and you'll do the same thing yourself. First, my mother said, whenever you point at somebody, you have three fingers pointing back at yourself.
Classic,
right?
Yeah.
Right. So,
this is the speck and plank in the eyes that Jesus talks
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Now, but now, look down in verse 14. All right. I'm sorry, 17. Now you, if you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and boast in God, if you know his will and approve of what is superior because you're instructed by the law, there's Torah, right?
Yeah.
If you're convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of little children, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Now, there's lots of debate about this. What I think is going on here is this goes back, and the reason I mention this is this goes back to that revelation that he's talking about, revealing that God's righteousness and God's wrath has now come through the Messiah,
mm-hmm.
not through Torah observance, right? Mm-hmm. I think it is this idea that it is through the Messiah, and so you know that's the new revelation, and especially for the Jew. Right. So he's saying here's the big deal, is we are no better, right? Those who were born Jews are no better than the Gentiles because we have also followed in the same way. And this is going to be his point throughout, that his own countrymen, then we're going, now we're going
to the playing field has been leveled.
Yeah, in a way, or yeah, it's a recognition that all of us have needed this justification, to use that term, from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Not only the Gentiles, but also the Jews. We are dependent upon this as well. And that's what chapters 9 through 11 of the book of Romans are about.
Okay.
That the Jewish people as well need to understand of their absolute reliance upon the Messiah. I would consider myself cursed, cut off from Christ, Paul says, if my own countrymen would come to faith in Jesus. So that's what I think is going on here. Any other comments or questions on that?
No, that's great. You know, there's a lot going on in there. I think it's I'd read a book a couple years ago from Scott McKnight, and it's called Reading Romans Backwards.
Right.
But he takes this opening section and say, like, this is, I think he references that there was somewhere else that this kind of view of the Gentiles is written. And so it's the same thing what you're saying is, he's like, the Jews are sitting there kind of going, yeah, these are all the things we believe about the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, this is all them, you know, kind of the same thing that this is a, for them, they're celebrating, like, yeah.
Get him, Paul. Right. Get him.
Yeah, get him. And that it's just this flip on the head here that is, that's interesting. But I think this is a great connection to talk about the revelation of the wrath. You know what I mean? That is, that Paul's setting up his position here very early in Romans that he's going to expound upon later this.
And chapter 5, you have this whole idea, Genesis, sin entered the world through one man. You have this idea of Adam. And so again, it's that going back to creation, and sin enters there. And even before the law is given, there's sin, right? We don't have to have the law in order to sin. And he goes on and he talks about verse 20, the law was brought in so that trespasses might increase. This is chapter 5, verse 20. The law just makes us aware of sin, as Paul says in chapter 7. You know, so this is not just a one-off. This is him setting this up, and he's going to come back to it, I think, again and again. Let me read another book. This is from Ephesians chapter 2, because I think it is – oh, I think I just closed it. It is Paul saying the same thing that I think he's saying here. And this is the first three verses of Ephesians chapter 2. Paul writes there to the church. I think the church is in the region of Asia Minor, but that's another issue. As for you, you were all y'all, right? This is plural. You were dead in your transgressions and sin, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of the world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us, so all you all lived in this way, all of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh, following its desires, darkened heart, right? Gratifying the cravings of our flesh, following its desires and thoughts.
With the knowledge.
So you see the same thing. It's knowledge, will, and action, right? All three of those have to be sanctified. Our minds have to be transformed. Romans chapter 12. Our will has to be suborned. Our will has to be put in under God's will. Not my will, but yours be done. And then our actions follow that. We get it backwards. You know, this is why Christianity is seen as a moralistic religion sometimes, because we've misunderstood. But anyway, that's another issue. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh, following its desires and thoughts, like the rest. Who? What does that mean? We were by nature deserving of wrath. By nature deserving of wrath. So I think Paul here again is saying, not just right,
Gentile,
but also the Jews, like the rest, we were all deserving of by nature, right?
This is the revelation. That
I think so.
All
have sinned and have fallen short. Both Jew and Gentile, I think, is the point there. Not, it includes all of us, but I think Paul's primary point is all of us need Jesus, our justification, our righteousness is in him now. Christ, mm-hmm. our righteousness, right? That's what Paul says elsewhere. That's the point that the
righteousness that Jesus revealed is also revealing a wrath, that a righteousness that is for all.
Yeah,
from first to last. Yeah, right. And it's a wrath that is for all, from first to last.
Right, yeah, for those who...
Who are other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Excellent. Well, Brian, thanks so much.
Yeah,
it's a fun conversation. I did really like it. I mean, we went through some.
We should
stuff.
Do some more in Romans, I guess. And I'm surprised we haven't
Romans
done more.
Romans has got some stuff in it. I guess we could talk about. But if so, we referenced N.T. Wright a lot. If you like N.T. Wright, or if you've never read N.T. Wright, you can go to our bookstore on thebiblebeacher.com. It's a bookstore. You can go in there. All you do is click on a link. It takes you to Amazon. Yeah. We had a book sold on there recently. This book, we got 82 cents, Brian.
Nice.
But that person paid no extra money for that. So you can go through there. We got a lot of N.T. Wright books on there.
We took 82 cents out of Bezos' pocket.
Yeah, take that, Jeff.
What's that guy going to do?
I think he just bought another $90 million property in Florida. But I got 82 cents, you know what I'm saying? So if you're enjoying the podcast, you want to dive into some of this, so I'll put some of those other books up there.
Yeah, I just say, so we kind of kidded about Paul and the Faithfulness of God, but he's got a couple of other books that are about this kind of topic that aren't nearly as...
loquacious.
Big.
Yes. He's got some everyday stuff, and then he's got some stuff if you want to dive a little deeper. Yeah. We'll put some of that on there. But this is a great topic for us to think about. Yeah. You know, I really appreciate going through scripture like this and seeing some of those nuances, seeing like, oh, why did they break this here? But seeing how this
goes together. You're right. It's crazy. And like I think what you said was very important. Even the way our Bibles are formatted, you know, affect how we read it. So
yeah. Yeah, so if you're enjoying, you can go to thebiblebeacher.com. You can look at some of the books. You can watch us there. You can watch the video. If you're a lot of folks are listening on Apple Podcasts. If you would, you can go to the Apple Podcast app and you can rate us, give us a ranking. If you're appreciating the podcast, you know, give us a little shout out on there. Yeah. Appreciate it. Helps other people find it.
If you have any response to this, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say to this.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Brian, thanks so much.
Yeah.
And we'll be back next Tuesday. And I think we're going to talk some Revelation.
Haven't done that for a long time. That's if you've stuck through Leviticus, your reward is we're going to talk about Revelation a little
bit. Everybody loves a little Revelation, don't they?
Yeah. Just look at Facebook.
Yeah. Speaking of Eclipse. Revelation. All right. So, Brian, thanks so much. And we'll chat next Tuesday.
All right. Bye.